Welcome in, wrong side of the pond. He is DJ Switzer. I am Jeremy Lance. I don't know what day it is, but we're podcasting, so it's a good day.
Is it April? I think it's April, isn't it?
April. My youngest birthday is soon.
Okay.
I should probably nail that down a little more definitively, but that's coming up.
Wait, I know that today is 420, not because of marijuana, you pothead hippies.
No, but, certainly not that.
No, but because today is my mom's birthday, so I do actually kind of know what day of the week it is and month it is. So,
did you ever throw at her the correlation of the fact that she shares a birthday with Hitler?
I 1,000,000% did. She also shared a birthday with my fourth grade teacher, who I actually loved. So, you know, there's a lot going on with 420, on top of the shenanigans you get into and the college age and all that kind of stuff. So, it's a complicated day, for me. So I actually know what it is, but if it weren't for this big fence post, or milepost set up in the middle of this day, I don't think I'd have any clue what it is at all.
Yeah. Sounds like you normally have a pretty full dance card on this day.
So celebrating Hitler's birthday is really important for me and my family, obviously.
Gotta recognize, I guess. How you been?
I'm fine. I don't know. What is being good or bad or anything anymore? It's all the same. So it's all just the same stuff.
Yeah. That's about right.
Yeah. You're having the same existential crisis, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I think when we started this call, you asked me how I'm doing. I was like, well, I'm existing, which is about all we can do at this point.
Yeah. I'm not aware of being able to do anything else aside from existing at this point. So why not get together and record our attempt at conversations about the nothingness that's happening at the moment?
Because of the nothingness and the void, we have both opted to dive into the ESPN Plus MLS archives. We've picked different games. DJ, what are you watching on your screen?
I'm currently watching the 2001 MLS Cup Final between the San Jose Earthquakes and LA Galaxy, and it's near and dear to my heart because it's the first MLS Cup final that I actually went to. It was at Cruz Stadium right here in Ohio. So that was kind of an exciting aspect of it.
I guess that was right around the twilight of the let's do a neutral site, right?
They
sorted out soon after that, right?
Hey, I think it lingered on for a few years after this. I think this was probably one of those turning points, though. I'm watching this game, and the very first goal that we're seeing scored here is where the stage currently is at Cruz Stadium, Mapfre Stadium, and it's very clear that half the stand behind it is completely empty. And thank God MLS finally kind of saw the light with these neutral venue, trying to make it a bit like the Super Bowl, right? A destination that all the fans, soccer fans in the country would want to go to. And, it's a decent sized crowd out there for this MLS Cup final. And I remember it feeling lively and festive. But when you're watching it on TV and you're seeing chunks of the stadium that are missing in your championship game, because there's not a local population there to try to suck it up and build the atmosphere. It was a very wise decision on their end to finally pull their head out of the sand.
Indeed. So I'm also watching a match that's taking place at Cruz Stadium. This is the 2008 Eastern Conference final between Eddie Gavin and Scalotto-led Crew versus your buddy, Chris Rolfe. His great friend Blanco, and the rest of the Chicago Fire.
Yeah, also a game I was in attendance for. The Crew obviously went on to not only win that game, but then go on and win the subsequent match in MLS Cup final, which was also played in a neutral venue, to give you an idea of how much longer it stuck around after the 2001 final that I'm watching right now. That 2008 final was played at the home, then the Home Depot Center out in LA. So yeah, I mean, a sign that they didn't really take their head out of the sand until not all that long ago, at least in the grand scheme of things.
Man. I just don't know why you don't make that move pretty good. I feel like that was a pretty easy move to make of like, hey, wouldn't it be nice if this thing we want people to think matters actually has full stands when they turn it on?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think there are two factors that really led to that, right? The first aspect of this is the idea that this is a league that was propped up by NFL owners and still, for the most part, is propped up by NFL owners. So they were trying their best to try to replicate the NFL experience within the realm of soccer, especially at this point in the league's existence, right? It was the idea of you would have in a neutral venue, like I was saying earlier, make it a destination that fans, no matter the team that you played for or rooted or wanted to get behind, you would still want to go to that final, and having a neutral site venue makes it a lot easier for people to plan out well in advance. The other thing that I think that really drives this decision-making, especially for MLS in the early years, is that when you get to plan it out in advance, that actually makes things cheaper because you're able to rent all the stuff that you need in earlier locations, get that ironed out way earlier in advance instead of having to wait until 2-3 weeks before the actual final itself and secure all these things, which may be harder to find. And those type of contracts are almost always more expensive when you need things on shorter terms. So that's a big aspect of it. And MLS is so transfixed by the idea of cost controls at that point, that having it planned well in advance, playing it in their own soccer specific stadiums, was a big aspect of it. It was trying to control the costs.
Yeah, no, that certainly made sense. I do wonder, like, if they really want to steer into the skid there, let's make it kind of like the NFL experience. Like, at what point do they try to, I'm guessing the naming, or the rights are available for the term soccer bowl. Should we just go back to that since the NASL is not going to be using that anytime soon?
Oh man, I'm sure some person acquired that in the fire sale that was the ending of the NASL, even though it's still kind of a thing.
We'll see. At least in this economy? Oh, okay.
At least on paper in the courts, it's a thing. But yeah, I mean, I'm for that. Bring it back.
It's a lifestyle apparel brand. Yeah. Like it really was for, what? The other big gap between its existence.
Yeah.
So again, we find ourselves with not a ton of news. I guess what the big thing is, like, the Bundesliga pretty much has obviously things are always kind of fluid in this current situation we live in, but kind of has a start back date.
Yeah. So it's more like it's going to be May 9th, that the Bundesliga is going to attempt to restart behind closed doors, no fans in attendance. And honestly, if there's a place that you'd expect this to happen, you'd expect it to be a place like Germany or maybe Japan, where like, people are really all about the societal aspects, like culturally, the German society is far more about like obedience, and they're far more likely to think of the collective than they are, the selfishness, kind of individualism. That's kind of the way that we would picture Germany. And you can see them having like really strict guidelines that they would follow, and like everyone would follow those rules. Like, Germany would be a place you could do that.
Historically, that has not always gone well. But yeah, that's how they roll over there. Also a country that's just very clean.
Yeah.
Like, they just kind of have a better grasp on that. So to kind of like lock down and keep things sanitary, that seems like they could probably pull that off relatively well. But so they're tracking towards that. teams are basically back in training at this point, right? I mean, they were already kind of training in like basically groups of like two and three guys.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, because again, that's what we're going to have to get the ramp up for, right? Is like whenever MLS decides, hey, we're back and going to be doing something again, like the first thing is going to be like, hey, players, you can actually show up at your training facility and, you know, do something.
Yeah. I mean, some of the things they're talking about, at least in England, when the players are allowed to return to training, is they would show up, they would participate in training, they would then go home and continue to do their cool down exercises and their showering and those kind of things at home. Just so they would limit exposure between each other. And then, of course, everyone would be getting their temperatures taken before and after, before they enter any facilities. There was a really cool article I was reading today that was kind of just outlining everything you would need to do to even just to play games behind closed doors, and imagining that teams are traveling, like the necessity to have like a safe, decontaminated route in the stadium for them to walk through. So that way they knew that they weren't going to be exposed to anything would be a necessity right now. And some things that like, sometimes it's easy to just say like, oh, just open up the stadiums and let people play games. Well, it's not that easy when you're trying to actually minimize the exposure that people are facing. So while we're hearing like in Germany, like, hey, May 9th, like you would assume they've got a lot of these things ironed out already.
Right. Well, and also like most European countries, they also have a pretty good grasp on the quantity and availability of just testing.
Yep.
Which is one of the problems I think we're going to have, is that we're just not there in any manner or form of just having enough ready available testing.
Kind of mind-boggling, you know, that they weren't that far ahead of us in receiving. No. You know,
I mean, granted, they had to buy a few less than we do, but
true. There's that, but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we're talking about Germany kind of have their idea on when they're going to make this all start up again, and you know, here we're hearing indefinite kind of suspension of the season. We're still not sure. MLS has repetitively changed their tune as to how much of the season they're willing to play or wanting to cut.
Right.
You know, in the Premier League, the only thing they can agree upon right now is that they don't want to cancel the season.
Right.
They don't want to null and void 2019-2020. And that's all they can agree to. They can't decide when they should start, which is honestly probably not a bad thing, given that no one really knows when it's going to be safe to return. And, you know, testing is a big aspect of it, but also being able to adequately test to see if people have antibodies, whether or not they're actually immune. And then, of course, if you don't have either of those things, is there going to be a vaccine that's available for them? And those are all things that are being measured as to when people can return to play. And if we're talking vaccine being the like the cutoff point, we're looking into next year before that season can even be finished.
And I don't think it's speaking,
I mean, you asked me on last week's show, would I remain, you know, when do I think we're playing soccer again? And I certainly don't think we're playing soccer anytime soon in front of fans, but I do think we're going to be seeing MLS soccer and European soccer returning to the pitch, but well before the end of this year.
We mentioned though, so, you know, Germany can just go, hey, this is what we're doing as Germany, and England can kind of do this is what we're doing as England. I think one of the other problems we face here with MLS is, and obviously in USL and others, we don't work that way in a lot of ways. I mean, the government in California is talking about they're not even thinking about doing stuff till late July, and they, you know, they don't want any events or any crowds or anything where people are showing up together for a much longer time than some other places in the country are. And then you have places, you have a handful of states in the country that are starting to do kind of like phase one opening like this week. So that's kind of the other dynamic, is like you have different parts of the country which have teams scattered throughout that are kind of at different paces with this and at different points in the progress with it, and have governments that have different mindsets on how to go about things.
Yeah. Not to mention a lack of clear leadership and direction coming from the top of the food chain, given also on top of the fact that it's not necessarily something that one person or any one entity can make a decision on, kind of like you're saying. Right. So, so
fun times.
Who knows when we'll get to restart any of this. But it sounds like Germany will at least be on the front leading edge of that. Let's talk about some things that we know have actually transpired is what I'm looking
for. Transpired is the one you wanted.
Yeah. And it's not really much, but there has been some really interesting things. Let's stay on this side of the pond. Wayne Rooney declaring that American soccer owners abusing the system that exists within MLS to prevent players from making more money and getting the freedoms that they want. The ever self-loathing American soccer fans on Twitter jumped all over this and used it to blow all of their various bovations about things they hate about American soccer. Everything from pro rel to MLS's cartel to everything out there. But Wayne's probably the most, high key former MLS player to really come out and just kind of rip the league this way.
Well, yeah, because it's interesting because it's a guy that was a designated player making good money coming in, and ultimately, yeah, what he's kind of the statements he's making are statements in support of the better treatment of really a lot of the players on the opposite end of the spectrum of him, the guys that aren't making a great deal of money and find themselves just, in the American system of just trading player for player, or in MLS case, player for, money, player for GAM and TAM, is just kind of just a very unfair way to go about things for those players. It's kind of a rough thing for them.
Yeah, I mean, just to even get free agency within MLS, there are so many stipulations for a player to have played so many years, to have, been with the same team for a certain amount of stretch. Those are all really difficult things for, a player to really do, especially if you're a younger player and you can't find your feet within a squad. And, if you have to spend a certain amount of time with them, that's hard to do when you're not actually getting minutes. And there's just not a whole lot of freedom to movement for players within Major League Soccer. And that's extra frustrating for, not just younger players, but also experienced players. I mean, I can tell you, chatting with more than a few MLS players who've been very successful, that have complained that it's been difficult for them to even make moves abroad because of how much MLS values them at, because they're trying to really turn a profit when selling them, right? And so it's a very difficult system for MLS players to work within. Obviously, if you're a player who's trying to chase the dream, you're going to go with whatever pathway gives you that. And if you're an American, MLS provides one of the most clear and obvious ways to do that. But when your options are restricted, it makes things a little bit more difficult. So Wayne speaking out for everyone, not just those low wage earners, but also the players at the top end of the scale, who are pretty restricted by the way MLS's system is set up. And he feels it's the ownership's fault. And it's an easy eye to point at someone. And it's not all that surprising that they would, Wayne would finger the ownership for that. And he specifically called out, like, hey, did these owners own other sports teams and they paid those players, gajillions of dollars to actually play those sports? And why aren't MLS players getting those same things? And I think there's some clear answers.
They're in leagues that also generate gajillions of dollars.
Exactly.
NFL prints money.
Yeah. I mean, MLS still has a pretty minuscule TV deal. And I think that's the main reason for that, as we sit and watch, you know, championship games in front of stadiums that are not necessarily full, you know, less than 20 years ago. That's part of the reason why players aren't getting monster contracts in Major League Soccer.
Oh, by the way, in this match, I completely forgot that Brian McBride scores for Chicago, and he had to had to catch himself from celebrating. You could tell he was getting ready to, and then he's like, "Oh nope, I should probably not do that."
Yeah. Remember that specifically. It was not a fond moment for many people at Crew Stadium that day. One other big bit of news that I think we certainly need to hit on is Newcastle United finally being liberated from the icy cold grip of their loathed owner, Mike Ashley, who may or may not be considered one of the least favorite owners within the Premier League, or at least English soccer ranks. And they are now owned by a man who stirs much controversy, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman.
That guy's not known for stuff, is he?
I mean, he once likely laundered a bunch of money by buying what may or may not have been a Leonardo da Vinci painting.
Okay. I mean, that's fine. As long as he didn't have, like, a journalist killed or anything, I think we're fine then.
Yeah, I don't think he's had any Turkish journalists who were writing for the New York Times and living in exile in the United States. I don't think he had any of those type of journalists murdered.
Okay, cool. I mean, I'm just looking at first news hit that I see when I put in his name. Says that Saudi executions have doubled despite his promise. So, you know, I mean, campaign promises are only one thing, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you're a prince, you don't really exactly run campaigns. So,
oh, no. Oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah, it is a bummer. But, hey, as long as it's not Mike Ashley, who doesn't spend money on anything, I mean, it seems a certainty. Not that acquisitions of, you know, Manchester City by, you know, some United Arab Emirates sheiks, right? Is any different, or Qatar's acquisition of PSG, or all the money that Qatar has been pumping into, you know, everything from Real Madrid to Barcelona to, you know, all these clubs all over the place. Not that any of these is any different, but this one just seems so blatant as, like, I'm buying a soccer club to try to cleanse my reputation.
Yeah. I mean, but hey, at least he's not like a dumpy fat guy that owns the Dick's Sporting Goods of the UK. So
yeah, it could be fine. Worse.
Everything's awesome.
If there's one thing I will say, and I think I tweeted about this earlier, was the idea that Newcastle have like a really old looking soccer badge, like a badge that looks very, I don't know, like 1920s era-esque. I mean, it has two freaking seahorses on it. I feel like given the state of the club on the pitch over the last, you know, 15, 20 years, their decline, their new era under an owner who's really trying to spiff up his own image, not just that of his acquisitions and properties. I think Newcastle are totally in line for a rebrand of some sorts, like a crest refresh.
Ooh.
Yeah.
It'll just be the Juventus, new Juventus logo, but it'll be an N instead of a J.
Oh, man, I've seen someone else make that same joke in a reply to mine as well, which is fantastic. yeah, definitely just, you know, stripey N, make it kind of allude to a crest shape. Done.
Love it. Put it on print. There, let's do it.
Perfect. So maybe better. Yeah, maybe better times ahead for Newcastle. Although, if you disagree publicly, with the new ownership, he may or may not try to have you executed within the bowels of St. James Park.
I'd keep that under your hat. Is that all we got?
Yeah, I think that's all we got. Is this where you probably want to end the show?
Sure.
Sure, why not? If you tuned into last week's show, you'll know that we did things a little bit different given the low amount of actual soccer news for us to talk about. Instead of us talking about our favorite things we like to watch or, you know, our places we want to go, we kind of flipped the script and wanted to interview one another over this two-show stretch to try to give a little bit more background on each of us. You know, we've alluded to over the years in bits and pieces, like how we actually ended up in this place where we've been recording a podcast together for nearly 7 whole years. But we've never really put all that together in one location. And Jeremy put me under the spotlight last week, and I felt the intense heat and of the scrutiny of having to answer all sorts of personal questions. So now it's his turn, and I got the ball rolling by trying to embarrass him on Twitter by posting a dopey picture of him from whatever year, and you just tried to one-up me.
That was a senior class photo.
Don't all
that would be trying my hardest.
But all senior class photos make you end up looking dopey, don't they?
Oh, yeah, totally. For the money that is spent on those, I don't think anyone has ever looked back 10 years later and thought, boy, this is fun. I'm glad we can look at this. I look awesome still. Like, cause I mean, you do one of two things.
Yeah.
You look way too like, you know, Sears holiday photo portrait, like glamour shots, or you try to go a little too into like what the current fashion is, which obviously then just dates the photo so horribly so quickly.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I remember the big trend when I was graduating back at the turn of the millennium was, especially if you played sports, taking a picture of you holding whatever sports ball it is you play with.
Oh yeah.
And having a flame superimposed over top of the ball that you play with. Like, ooh, I made this so scorching hot that it bursts into flames.
Oh, man. Just the graphic designs back then were just, Life Touch really knew what they were doing.
Yeah, they certainly did. All right, well, let's get into your interview this time around and unveil the curtain on what exactly it is that got Jeremy Lance to be stuck on a weekly recording with me all these years later. So let's start with some of the obvious questions that I think we should probably hit on out there. And, you know, I don't think this is going to be too different from mine outside of the fact that you did not play and spend your entire life like living and breathing soccer. So it's a little bit different path that you got to this point where you're like, sure, talking about soccer on a regular basis and somewhat being considered a pundit, if you will.
If I will. Yeah.
You would consider yourself that, right?
Sure. Yeah, I guess. I mean, in my head.
All right. So let's find out where the story begins. Where did you begin your life with soccer? I'm assuming you were like a typical kid from the middle class in the Midwest. You probably played some youth soccer growing up, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So played a little bit of youth soccer. It was not the sport I ended up sticking with. So I played probably, I think, maybe two seasons. In third and fourth grade. I want to say it was kind of around the time we were getting ready to possibly move to not Milwaukee and leave Wisconsin. So, played a little bit. Was terrible. Was absolutely terrible. One of my biggest memories of playing was, so one of my good buddy who lived across the street from me, Joey Finn, his dad was the coach. His dad was basically like one of the dudes from the Chicago Superfan skit on SNL.
Okay.
Just imagine that guy as your coach.
Yep.
Joey was playing as our goalkeeper. He did. I remember. I don't know exactly what he did in the match. I want to say he fell going for the ball and like hit his head or his face against like the post. I want to say that it's some sort of injury like that where he had to come out. No one else wanted to play in goal, and I was the slowest kid on the team. So they're like, "Hey, you go in goal," and I remember that being a complete disaster. Mainly because within the first 20 seconds, the ball is played back to me. I go to grab it. I have my hands on it, and this kid comes and kicks just my hand, not the ball, my hand. And obviously that hurt, so I let go, and the ball goes in. And my coach and everyone's like, "Oh, why did you?" And I'm like, "The guy just kicked me in. Can he do that? Is that legal? Did he just kick me in the back of my hand? Just straight up?" So it was just a horrific, I bet the grand total of time that I actually was in goal was maybe 2 or 3 minutes, but it was one of those terrible moments where it felt like time had stopped and it never ended.
Yeah.
I just remember that as the lasting traumatizing memory of playing youth soccer.
Right. So the firing squad, right? It felt like in your mind that you faced 50 shots mm-hmm. during that 4 minute spell in goal. Yeah. And in reality, it's probably three.
Yeah.
And that hand moment.
I guess we'll count that as a shot.
Yeah. Not a good sign either when your enduring memory of your soccer career is a time where you got kicked in the hand. Likely in the fourth grade. When do you think the last time was that you actually played a game of soccer? Obviously, that was youth soccer. Maybe you had some intramural games or any times you maybe played some adult indoor or anything like that.
I played a hot minute of an adult indoor season. Actually, I mean, a whole season at a place you know very well, Wall to Wall. It was a church group that was like, "Hey, we're playing," and somehow I just kind of got people were just like, "Hey, you're just going to play. You're on the team. We've already signed you up. You're playing." And it wasn't really a discussion of if I wanted to or not, or even still had cleats. So yeah, that would probably been 2008, 2009.
Okay.
Not like a million years ago.
All right. It's in this millennium at least. So I at least feel better about that. So you've alluded to the fact that soccer wasn't the sport that you ended up sticking with. I know well what other sports you went on and play, but why don't you tell our listeners out there where you got your kicks in?
So most kids, I played a little bit of what was mainly available. So I played a little soccer, played a little bit of t-ball and stuff like that. But the sport that I ended up playing for probably, I think I started in sixth grade and played all the way through, I want to say freshman year of high school, was hockey. Mainly actually roller hockey, because there just wasn't a whole lot of ice hockey going on in Southwest Ohio.
Yeah.
That was the sport I played. Two things about that. One, I grew up, when I was younger, I lived in Milwaukee. Ice skating was something I was introduced to at a super young age. So ice skating and roller skating was actually something I felt very comfortable with, even at a relatively young age.
Yeah.
We actually would go the Olympic speed skating training center was in the town in Milwaukee we lived in. So we would go there and learn how to skate there. So that was something I was good with.
Sorry to interrupt, but you that means you loved, once you moved to Ohio, the mandatory skating parties that were a part of going to school here in Ohio, right?
Yeah, I did. I actually, that was one of like the few things that oddly didn't take place, or at least maybe at the age level, like when I lived in Milwaukee, like there wasn't a lot of skating rinks for people to like have parties like that. So when I moved here and there was like all these like roller skating rink school parties, I was like, this is my zone. Like I'm good here. Like this is, I can do this. Like I can actually kind of show out a little bit. I can just bypass the rental counter because I own my own, you know, that kind of thing. But the other main thing of why hockey was the sport I played was because, so I was actually born with a pretty serious heart condition. Mm-hmm. So my stamina and just ability to just do a physical activity for a very long stretch of time just doesn't really exist. So in hockey, you just go, you play in shifts that go pretty quick. I mean, a shift is really only going to last like 90 seconds, you know, 2-3 minutes at the extreme. And then you go and you sit down for a couple minutes. So just by that nature, it was like the sport that was the most conducive for my condition, soccer being the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, I was getting ready to say soccer is, it's almost a necessity for you to murder yourself over long periods of time to actually get well in the sport. So.
Yeah, the one thing I was never going to be able to do was to just play at a long duration like that. So it was just never going to be in the cards.
Yeah, bomb the wings for 90 minutes, please, Jeremy.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
You might lay down for half of that or all of it. So where, you got it.
So soccer obviously wasn't what you focused on. You played a bit of hockey. Where does soccer rank in your kind of sports pantheon right now, right? Like I know you're a big fan of some other sports, and we'll get into that here in a minute, but like if you rank soccer as far as your like sport you enjoyed the most now or got the most enjoyment from, would you rank it one?
It's definitely one now. And it's probably been one, I'd say it definitely took over probably around college, probably around the time that I was just able to watch a lot more of it.
Mm-hmm.
And where it was just more readily available and I could just kind of get into it more. Cause obviously, I mean, we've talked about this before when you're younger, in the 90s and even in the early parts of the 2000s, watching soccer on TV was just not an easy feat. Mm-hmm. Unless you had quite the cable package. It was a bit of a chore.
Yeah, that it was. So Chelsea is your big club that you support, at least over in England. I would say it's hands down one of your favorite sports teams. And I'm going to list out your other ones. The Cubs in baseball, the Blackhawks in hockey, the Packers in football, and the Bucks in basketball. These are all teams that you like and follow.
Bucks, a distant last place on that depth chart, just mainly because always been awful my whole life, except for kind of right now. And I'm just not a big basketball watcher.
All right, fair enough. So where would you rank Chelsea amongst those that are your favorite teams to watch sports for?
Yeah, again, it's probably one, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that, like, I can't sit through a baseball game anymore. Like, I can't do it. Unless it's like playoffs, I can't sit there and watch a baseball game that means, you know, there's 162 of them, and most of them don't matter. I can't really do it. Can't really bring myself to watch it, so I don't watch the Cubs play a whole lot. Packers, if they're on, I'm going to watch it. There's a lot less inventory to have to worry about. You can watch your 16 games in the season and whatever playoffs, and that's actually not that much of a commitment in the grand scheme of things. So, yeah, I'd say Chelsea is definitely the top a lot for that, and just because that's just kind of what I care about.
Yeah, a lot of success for you over the last few years amongst those teams, minus the Bucks.
Yeah, no, things have been good. Three Stanley Cups, World Series, and 12 to 13 trophies for Chelsea. So,
I'm sitting here thinking about over the last decade how many trophies the teams that I support actually do. And I'm like sitting here, Spurs, none. The Reds, none. The Bengals, none. The Pistons were good like a little bit ago, and the Red Wings were good a little bit ago, but that seems like an eternity ago at this point, especially given COVID situation. So, hey, at least you got all that going for you to make up for the Bucks' inferiority.
There you go. Yeah.
So let's pivot away from kind of your playing and supporting sports background and get a little bit into more how you ended up here. And it's kind of your sports journalism background. And you and I met through sports journalism endeavors at that fateful night in Pickwell, Ohio, as we watched Wigan Athletic take on the mighty Dayton Dutch Lions.
Take on the grass.
Yeah, that's right. But I wanted to kind of like, how long ago or you know, when did you first know that you were going to go into sports broadcasting or chase that type of dream?
So I think I always wanted to do something in the way of being on TV, being on the radio. I was just a weird kid that liked to listen to like radio. Like I listened to, and we're not talking music. Like FM radio is, I have never had a taste for. Like I was the kid listening to like sports talk radio when he was like 10. Yeah. I was that psycho. So like I've always wanted to do something involved with that. When I was a little kid, I was probably the only like third grader in America that aspired to be David Letterman and like said as much out loud. I always wanted to do that and be like in broadcasting and talking and being on shows. And if I wasn't so against just the general mechanics of just being on stage alone, I probably actually would have gone into like stand-up comedy maybe. But I used to do theater when I was younger. And then like just one day I decided I do not want to be on the stage acting or doing anything like that where I see the audience right there. So I think within that is kind of where I really started to pivot hard towards I want to be in radio. So it was something I kind of just started chasing sort of in high school. You know, to be a part of it. I think I did the morning announcements at our high school. And then in college, I worked at the college radio station, did some sports broadcasting there. And then from there, I just kind of started getting broadcasting jobs. Worked at a handful of radio stations in Cincinnati. So started out as just I got a gig through someone I knew doing what's called a stringer. So that's someone that just goes to a sporting event, or even actually there's like news stringers that just go to whatever and collect the sound from the interviews. And in some cases like write and speak out like a little, a little script of like the actual like news thing. And then you send it off, and then that goes to the company you work for, and the company you work for then spreads it out to everyone in their network. And then everyone in their network has the access to use that for their, you know, sports report, their news report, whatever they can, or they have the audio clips. If it's a sports talk show that wants to play the audio clip of that interview from that game last night, they have that. And so I was the guy that had to go get that. So I covered the Cincinnati Reds doing that. So it was me and like two other guys, because it's kind of a pain to do all those games by yourself. So we kind of split it all up. So I'd do like 30 or so Reds games every season starting in 2009. I think that I kind of stopped doing that in 2015, I want to say, as kind of all the companies started to buy each other out. And so instead of getting like four different checks from four different outlets, I was just getting one check from one outlet because they had acquired the other three.
Right.
So it just didn't become, it was not lucrative because it's kind of a long thing. You get to, you know, for a Reds game, I get to the stadium around, you know, 5:30. So I'm fighting through traffic starting at like a little after 4 to get to the stadium at 5:30, get set up. The game starts at like 7:10. The game ends around like 9:45, 10 o'clock. Then I wait, go down and wait for players to become available, interview them, go over to the other side, interview other players, go upstairs, cut all the audio up, type it out, email it out, drive home. And by that point, it's 1 a.m. And like, yep. it just didn't become, it was just no longer worth my time. So that was like one of the first things I ended up doing, and I ended up doing that for a while. I worked on a handful of radio stations in the area, none of them that big. So I worked as a producer, a morning show producer at WMOH, which is up in like the Hamilton, like suburban area of northern Cincinnati. I actually still do some work for them during the high school football season.
It's actually really, where we
really just in here.
That's the first place we recorded the show.
Yeah. So when we first decided to start doing this podcast, I was still the producer there. So I had access to all of ours, all the studios there, all two of them. And yeah, we would do the show there back when it sounded a little more professional, at least from an audio standpoint.
Sure.
So yeah, I worked there for a couple of years. I worked at another station that was just run by some total crooks. That was a lot of fun. We were told at one point we were getting our own like afternoon drive time talk show, like me and my buddy. And we were so excited and we were telling everybody, and like we did an interview with the local media reported for the Inquirer about how we were taking over and these like young guys coming in. And then the station manager, who I think might actually be in prison at this point, he did a lot of shady deals where basically he would just sell advertising so he could get like free meals at places. Like money was actually not coming into the station the way sure. He was reporting it would be. So he all of a sudden just calls us and it's like, hey, we're adding. And it was like one of the guys that works on like the Reds TV broadcast. And he's like, and he's going to be the main guy and then you'll just be the sidekicks. And so like it went from like, hey, we're getting our own show to like, hey, we're going to like run the board and like chime in on this guy's show. And so it's kind of like getting the rug pulled out from under you. And it was kind of it was a horrible experience. The guy that they brought in ended up not really hanging around because it just, they weren't offering him enough money, so it wasn't worth his time. And he just kind of would barely be around, especially like during the baseball season. He was in studio for 0% of that because he was always either at the stadium or on the road. Mm-hmm. So that lasted for like a couple months. And then like they just basically just stopped paying us. And so I just stopped showing up. That's how legit radio is. People think that it's like this big, like, glamorous, cool, like professional broadcasting thing. It's a bunch of very strange, socially unadjusted people just running that industry. It's all run by just some very shady people, some people that just don't know how to just do actual like day-to-day business stuff. It's a weird place. There was a third station though that I worked for, and that actually kind of ties into where we started to where we met, is because I started working for this station. They were a new sports station in Cincinnati, and the programming director came to us once in this meeting and was like, "Hey, we want to do a lot of local programming, especially on the weekends." And I was kind of already had built up a reputation at that station and some other stations as kind of being like the soccer guy, because quite frankly, like there was nobody else that could even name like more than two MLS teams that work in sports broadcasting.
Right.
At least in Cincinnati. So I was kind of the de facto soccer guy. So he kind of like was like, well, you know, what do you, what would be your idea if we gave you like an hour or two to put some programming together? And I was like, well, I'd like to do like a soccer show. And like, I just met this guy that runs a website. I think we can do it. And he was all on board, and it was really cool. And then like the next, like 2 weeks later, I was leaving like Bengals training camp that I was there reporting, and got pulled into a 10 a.m. Out of nowhere conference call, and we were all let go, and the station was turned back into an oldies station.
Oh, perfect.
And has been ever since. So I guess that was the right move. So, yeah. You know, what do I know?
But that sowed the seeds, and that two-hour soccer show is what the podcast eventually became. We said, you know, hey. Yeah,
I think I told you, I was like, hey, so that radio thing isn't going to happen. You just want to do a podcast? And we're like, all right.
Sounds good to me. And here we are 7 years later trying to entertain you by, you know, talking about what used to be soccer. Let's talk about a couple other things real quick. You made working in sports radio seem terrible there. What was your favorite highlight, favorite moment of working as a sports radio, sports journalist over the last 10 or so years?
I mean, obviously, besides like just the fact that the money is terrible, everything is on shaky ground because, a station might just flip to an oldies station overnight and you're just out of a job. Or, you know, the people running it are like criminals. Within all of that and just dealing with the nonsense that comes with that, I mean, there were some amazing moments. I've got to cover so many sporting events. I've got to meet so many people, not just like, you know, not just big name athletes, but like, you know, just big name broadcasters. You know, it became, you know, covering the Reds was an interesting one because I got around that so much that like weird things that I took for granted became commonplace, like just riding in an elevator where it's just me and Chris Berman, largely because I don't think anyone else could fit in an elevator besides one other person when Chris Berman's in the elevator.
True.
Incredibly large man. The TV does not, they always say the TV adds 10 pounds. I don't know what's happening for Chris Berman. That was the opposite. When I saw him in person, I was dumbfounded by just how just physically large he was. Like not even like just like overly obese. Like he's like a very tall, massive, broad shoulder. Like he is just a gigantic human.
He's a big guy.
So yeah, I mean, just like normal things like that becomes normal. And like talking to, talking to guys like Marty Brenneman on the regular, who's, you know, kind of a bit of an idol because of just, you know, what he means to sports broadcasting and play by play in this city. A lot of that. So there's a lot of just smaller things, bigger stuff. Like I got to cover the tennis tournament here in Cincinnati for several years. And like, those are just like a week long party, at least for me. Cause I was actually required to do very little actual work. I had to get just a little bit of sound. Mm-hmm. And really it only mattered to get sound by like the four, you know, tennis players that people had actually heard of at the event. So like, you know, for the week long tournament, like, you know, 2/3 of those matches, the first like 4 days, like are completely irrelevant to me. Cause like, that's not what I'm going to be able to put on the air. So
right.
It was a lot of like hanging out and like drinking free Coronas in a press box and talking and like chatting up the dudes that work for like BBC Five and like talking about how like, you know, I listen to them sometimes and like, you know, asking them questions about like the, you know, phone in shows and stuff like that. Like that was cool. Like just stuff like that. Yeah.
It sounds a bit like your experience with the Mexican press and Rob Stone.
Yeah.
Say Mexico game.
That was a cool time.
Yeah.
What was that? That was the last Dos Acero, right? That was the 2013 edition.
It was.
Where, where I got paired up with Rob Stone in the seating chart.
Yep.
Super cool guy. And then, yeah, and then all the Mexican reporters in front of us were just crushing beers.
Why not?
Like, every time I look, because we were right by the door, and, like, there just seemed to be a constant stream of them walking in and out of that door, because they would have to go out of the press box onto, like, the main concourse, because, like, beer is not provided to the press. That's not really a thing.
No.
By and large.
No, it isn't.
Like, it used to be. I there was always, when I hung out with the guys that cover the Reds, like, they would always talk about the glory days of, like, the 90s when Marge Schott would pay for, like, a keg to be just rolled around the press box every night. I mean, those were the days. Obviously, there was some negatives with Marge Schott, but at least she had free beer.
Yeah.
Like, at least Hitler, the beer was cheap.
Like Hitler, she had some good ideas.
Yeah, certainly. You know, so that there's kind of a decorum in, like, how you're supposed to act. You know, there's no cheering in the press box. There's no, obviously, getting intoxicated in the press box kind of goes without saying. You know, just getting intoxicated at any job is generally frowned upon.
Sure.
And these guys were just blowing past both of those social norms as far as press work went. And so that was a blast to watch these guys just get tanked. And then the best was actually that, like, late that night, I'm leaving the press box and walking out of the stadium. And the press box was basically, like, behind the stage, like, where they set up the stands, where the stage is there at Moffrey. And it was right behind that. I'm leaving, and they still had, like, the studios going, like, the studio shows going for, like, I don't know, Telemundo or whoever, well, Unimas, whoever was running that. And these two guys, what I presume may have been on air, may have not been on air, full suits, sitting at this desk, like, literally just became unglued on each other. Like, they just started freaking out and about jumped the table on each other.
No beverages being consumed there at that point.
No, I mean, there might have been several already in their system, but no, none at the table, none at the dais there.
All right, fair.
All right.
So one of the things that you and I both kind of gotten to experience a little bit is a question that we got from Christine, the lady and listener who's kindly suggested, actually, that we even do this kind of series of interviewing one another. And that's the idea of, like, now that we've covered sports, now that we've worked within sports, has it ruined the sports for you in general? Like, there's this underbelly I've talked a lot about over the years on the show from working within professional sports. Has that tarnished it? Has it ruined the experience for you?
You know, I feel like there has been times where I could definitely say yes. Like, you know, I talked about the fact that I'm not a big baseball fan as much as I used to be. I would say a lot of that was, like, covering baseball for the 6-7 seasons kind of beat it out of me a little bit, where, like, I just didn't find joy in baseball games just because it became not about enjoying a game and just about, like, all the things I would have to do for it. So, like, I went through this huge stretch where, like, the only interactions I had with baseball were from a working perspective. So there was no times where I was just sitting there really watching and enjoying baseball, because it was always my interactions with it, because I just didn't have all the time in the world to just, you know, just constantly watching games when I'm home. What was the fact that, like, yeah, like, I was working, and, you know, I've talked about it, you know, as far as, like, the length of time you're there. And I know you mentioned it as far as, like, when you're working a match, like, those are long, not fun, kind of grueling days.
Yeah.
And that's your only, like, touch point with the sport. It absolutely can lead to that. Luckily I put myself in a situation after that where, like, I never wanted to be, unless I was making enough money to where it made sense, I never wanted to be fully ingrained in a way where the joy of a sport was gone.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't say that it's ruined sports for me. I think my understanding of pro sports is so much deeper now than it was. Like, you think you know what's going on when you're on the outside, and then once you're on the inside and you're actually seeing it, you get a much better appreciation for the machination and the wheels that are turning to actually make pro sports happen. I definitely think it's made me a little bit more cynical about my fandom, right? Where I'm not necessarily as invested in certain aspects of it as I used to be. Although I think, like, my highs are still really high. I don't think the lows get me quite as low as they used to back before I was quite as invested in it, at least from a financial standpoint. So, yeah, it's not ruined pro sports, but it's definitely, like, given it a new perspective.
Well, I think one thing within that, you know, I think that you throw around the term, like, you see the sausage get made, and that kind of, like, taints it for some people. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, it really didn't. Like, it was just kind of like this cool, like, ooh, I get to see, like, behind the curtain, where I could definitely see, like, for you, like, you were actually making the sausage. So, like, I just had to watch the sausage get made. You actually had to sit there and work the meat grinder as a member of an actual pro team staff.
Yeah, I suppose that's probably true.
Like, I could just sit there and go, like, holy crap, that's how it gets made. Like, now I know how it gets made. We're like, you're the one sitting there going, like, I got to make it.
Yeah. Not only that, but you're also going, wait, so how do we make this again? Like, does anyone know how to make this specifically? And the answer is usually no.
Oh, and if I make it wrong, people are going to be mad at me? Okay.
Dang it. All right. Let's move on then.
But to finish that, I would say I don't think it's ruined it for me, but that's also been an active attempt to make sure that it doesn't happen.
Well, as we wrap up this one, I've got one last question for you. One of the first jobs, actual paying jobs that you and I landed together in the world of soccer out of this was calling play-by-play for the Cincinnati Saints when they were in their MPSL in their first few seasons. Which you then went on to do more of as well, even once I was moved on into FC Cincinnati land. My question for you is, you were the play-by-play guy. I obviously did color. How hard was it calling games with me? It had to have been really difficult because I'm not very good at this whole speaking thing while trying to analyze all the soccer I'm watching.
Well, I mean, it worked out well because we were both like, I mean, I had a little bit of experience at that point as far as play-by-play. My play-by-play experience was still very limited to, like, stuff I had done in college. So we were both basically on a level playing field. So that made it easy. I've done broadcasts with, like, some guys that are very experienced. And there's always going to be, like, that little bit of room where, like, you guys figure out, like, hey, this is kind of my, like, flow of how I talk. And, like, you just learn how to weave those two. Like, this is how I talk. This is how I talk. This is when I want to say stuff. This is when I want to say stuff. And you just weave that. And there's always that kind of learning curve because most people don't just go, hey, so this is when you have to shut up, because most people aren't jerks like that. I have actually met a few guys that basically say, like, no, I just tell my color commentator, hey, this is when you're allowed to talk and this is when you're not, and you better shut up otherwise. But yeah, I think we pulled it off pretty well, I would say. Like, for two guys that were relatively inexperienced at it, had never, like, you know, most broadcasters to go into a situation like that probably would do like a couple trial runs, right?
Yeah.
You know, whether that would have been like us watching like some game tape and just trying to do some stuff, or us going to like a scrimmage in the preseason and just kind of pretending to do a broadcast. We just want raw dog that thing, went straight on in. And I thought it went all right.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of the harassing we got came from rival fans watching our streams. So,
I mean, we were an NPSL broadcast team, so, like, the bar was not, like, no one was crushing it,
no.
Right? Like, there was no, like, I mean, Detroit City was great, but like even they didn't really, up until like those like last couple years, had like a legit broadcast crew. Like everybody's kind of working at a pretty amateur level at that point.
Well, it is MPSO, not too unsurprising. Well, thanks, Jeremy, for all of your excellent input. Hopefully none of this was too awkward for you.
No, I love talking about just
yourself.
That was broadcasting.
Well, awesome. Well, thanks for tuning in as always. We'll let you guys go now and not subject you to the two of interviewing each other, hopefully too soon again, but maybe get back into these top 10 lists. I don't know. If you've got an idea for us and you don't want us to have to interview ourselves, that's one way of doing it. Get in touch with us. Jeremy's at Jeremy Lance on Twitter. I'm at Wrong Side of Pond. We have an email address, a contact form, all those things over at the website, Facebook page, whatever you need to do. Shoot us some suggestions so that way we don't have to do this again.
Sounds good.
All right, kids. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye. Monday. Yeah, I'm used to this. The same old shit. Left alone wherever I sit. Why this place so dry? No love to find. You're the only one that ever acts kind. They all laugh to me. What's happening? I wish that you could see what I see. Your boyfriend's a douche that thinks he's cool and doesn't deserve.